My name is Bill Lawrence. I have the honor and the privilege of serving as Dean at Perkins School of Theology, and that allows me the privilege of welcoming you to this afternoon's Faith and Business Luncheon. We're delighted that you're here, delighted that you've accepted the invitation to join us, and we look forward to a very special set of presentations by our two guests. I trust that you have already had lively and interesting conversations around your tables and are getting acquainted with some folks that have helped you enrich your day together already. Allow me to introduce then our two speakers. I will provide introductions for both of them, and then they will speak in sequence. We will hear first from Mr. Horton and then immediately afterwards from Dr. Marshall. But let me say a word about the two persons who are going to speak to us. And in doing so, let me remind you about the nature of the Faith and Business Luncheons at Perkins. We've been hosting these now for a couple of years and count it an enormous opportunity for us to bring together members of the religious community and members of the business and professional community by having a speaker from each segment of the community. And the two speakers selected for each occasion have opportunities to talk with each other and share perspectives in their own personal lives with all of us, as well as with each other, about the relationship between faith and business. The first person from whom you hear is Thomas W. Horton. He is Chair and Chief Executive Officer of AMR Corporation and American Airlines, and chair of One World Alliance, of which American is a founding member. He has a long track record of leadership and results in business transformation and operational performance. He became chair and CEO of AMR and American Airlines in November 2011. He joined the firm originally in 1985 and has held a broad range of leadership positions, including Vice President for American's International Business based in London, and later Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of AMR. He left AMR and American Airlines in 2002, joined AT&T, serving first as CFO and later Vice Chair in 2005. He led the evaluation and transformation of some of its strategic priorities, including the combination with SBC to form the new AT&T. In March 2006, he returned to American as Executive Vice President of Finance and Planning, became President in 2010, and Chair and CEO in 2011. That meant that he led the plan to restructure and renew the company's operations, including the largest ever new aircraft order, and culminating in the February 2013 decision to merge with U.S. Airways. Mr. Horton holds a Master of Business Administration degree from the Cox School of Business here at Southern Methodist University. He also has a Bachelor of Business Administration degree from Baylor University. He serves on the board of directors of Qualcomm, a leading developer and innovator of advanced wireless technologies and data solutions, and he is on the executive board of Cox School of Business here at Southern Methodist University. An avid runner, he has competed in several marathons and half marathons. He is married and the father of two children. Please join me in saying hello and thanks to Tom Horton. Bruce Marshall is the second speaker from whom you will hear. He is the Lehman Professor of Christian Doctrine at Perkins School of Theology and Director of the Graduate Program in Religious Studies at Southern Methodist University. Bruce earned his PhD from Yale University after having completed a master's degree at Yale and an undergraduate degree at Northwestern University. His special areas of teaching include medieval and Reformation theology, and systematic theology, including the history of Christian doctrine, apropos of the title of the chair that he holds. His research interests and the specific areas in which he is identified globally as an expert include the study of the doctrine of the Trinity, Christology, philosophical issues in theology, sacramental theology, and the relationships between Judaism and Christian theology. His publications have spanned these fields, and he is an extraordinary scholar with whom it is a great privilege to work. Bruce has served in a number of capacities here at Southern Methodist University and at Perkins School of Theology, but also across the world. He is a member of the Academy of Catholic Theology, an institution for which he served as president from 2008 to 2009. He is also a member of the National Endowment, or a fellow of the National Endowment for the Humanities. He has been a fellow of the Pew Evangelical Scholars Program, and he is on the editorial boards of two peer-reviewed scholarly journals. Bruce is an exceptional scholar and teacher. He is renowned among our faculty, colleagues, and our students as the person who expects the most of students and receives the greatest gratitude from the students from whom he expects the most. If anybody wonders, do students want to be pushed? Just ask how they feel after Bruce completes a demanding semester or academic year with them, and they will tell you, during the year, I wasn't so sure. But now I know. He's exactly the kind of professor I came to seminary to have. Please join me in greeting Dr. Bruce Marshall. We'll hear from Mr. Horton and then immediately afterwards from Dr. Marshall.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for having me here today. It is a great honor and even a little bit intimidating to be standing before you here today. You see, I was raised a Methodist. I went to a Baptist university, then on to SMU. I married a Catholic, became a Catholic, and I even attend Mass here at Perkins often. I root for Baylor, SMU, and Notre Dame. That was kind of a tough one. So I'm not sure what old Joe Perkins would think about me, but I'm glad to be here, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit today, not just about faith and business, but faith in business, and how they go together. And in doing so, I'd like to talk a little bit about the seemingly opposing subjects of American capitalism and humility. So let me start off with a little story about humility and an amazing coincidence. This takes place aboard an American 737 headed for Dallas. What are the odds of that? A very distinguished professor from the Harvard Business School is sitting there during boarding, and this is a pretty famous guy. He consults with CEOs all over the world, and he's sitting there. He's very well-dressed. He's reading his Wall Street Journal, and this older guy comes and sits down next to him, and the older guy is wearing coveralls and boots, and he has calloused hands, and they get to talking, and they get around to what each other does for a living. It turns out the older guy is a farmer, and he's headed back to his farm in Texas. So there's a bit of a delay at the gate, not American's fault. But it's weather or something. So the professor says, why don't we play a little quiz, a quiz game, and we can ask each other a question, and to make it interesting, we'll place a bet. And to make this fair, I'll ask you a question. If you don't know the answer, you pay me $5. Then you ask me a question, and if I don't know the answer, I'll pay you $500. So the older guy sort of looks at him and says, fair enough, and they flip a coin to start. And so the professor goes first, and he says, who's the head of the Central Bank of England? The farmer says, I don't know. Hands him $5. The professor says, your turn. So the farmer thinks a little bit, and he says, what animal walks up a hill with three legs and walks down with four? And the professor sort of scratches his head and thinks a bit and then finally gives up and says, I don't know. And he hands the farmer $500. So the old farmer tucks the money into his overalls, crosses his arms, leans back, closes his eyes to take a nap. And the professor says, hey, wait a minute. What type of animal is it that walks up a hill on three legs and comes down on four? And the farmer just grins, pulls out the wad of money, and hands the professor another $5. So the moral of that story is that humility is a great and useful virtue, and in this case, it was worth $490 to the farmer. But we're here to talk about the theme of faith and business, and maybe whether they even go together. I think they do, or I wouldn't be here, and I think they're related to our society's notion of faith in business, and very fundamentally related to the essence of American capitalism and economic freedom. But what does that have to do with humility? Well, I'd like to start with a confession. The confession is, and I confess this to Bruce, I am a full-throttle American capitalist. And I understand that that may be a little bit out of fashion in recent years, but I firmly believe that the American style of capitalism and economic freedom have been an enormous force for good in the world. And it's a big part of what we think of as American exceptionalism. So at the heart of liberty is economic freedom, the right to choose how we earn a living, how we spend our time, how we save and invest, how we provide for our families, and how we spend our money. And I always contend that economic freedom is very simply freedom itself. And history shows time and again that economic freedom goes hand in hand with political freedom. And I believe, as I'm sure many of you in this room do, that freedom is the greatest gift of God. But freedom and free will are always a double-edged sword. As the great economist and political philosopher Friedrich Hayek said, liberty means the individual has both the opportunity and the burden of choice. It also means he must bear the consequences of his actions. Liberty and responsibility are inseparable. So I believe that the concepts of economic of freedom that animate capitalism and Christianity really do go together. And I think it's no coincidence that this unique blend of Judeo-Christian principles and American capitalism have created the greatest nation on earth in a couple hundred years. So capitalism and Christianity do go together, in my view, because the former has been proven to create the greatest wealth and the most efficient system of allocating scarce goods and creating the highest level of standards around the world. Okay, so I know you're all thinking at this point, Tom has taken a wrong turn on his way to the Cox Business School today. It sounds like the theology of Milton Friedman. What the heck are you talking about? So I start with this modest defense of capitalism for a reason. As people of faith and goodwill, we all want the best for our families and we want the best for our fellow man. We want to do good, right? But the problem, of course, is with the best intentions, we start demanding government to do more good. And I think we know where that leads, and sometimes it's not pretty. So since we're at a premier theology school, it seemed the best way to express my views on this is with a story of the afterlife. American Airlines is not involved in this. There's a ruthless and corrupt man who dies and is sent to hell. And when he arrives, he's given a choice: socialist hell or capitalist hell. He notices a long line of people waiting to go into socialist hell, but not one person is waiting to get into capitalist hell. So he asks one of the guards, "What is socialist hell all about?" Well, in socialist hell, the guard says, they boil you in oil, whip you, and then put you on the rack. "Ouch," says the man. "What do they do in capitalist hell?" Guard says, the exact same thing. So the man was confused, and he says, "And why is everybody trying to get into socialist hell?" And the guard says, "Because in socialist hell, they're always out of oil, whips, and racks." Okay, so I'm guessing that since I'm here at SMU in Dallas, Texas, speaking to a lot of folks who are involved in the business community, I think the notion of capitalism as a force for good probably isn't a very hard sell. But I think we can all agree that it feels like in recent years things have gone a little off the rails. Faith in business and our form of capitalism has taken a hit, and some of that well earned. The financial crisis and the aftermath have been ascribed to so many sources: too much government, too little government, loose money, tight money, speculation, greed, stupidity, you name it. Faith and trust in business, though, is a very, very important thing. It is a huge part of what makes our system work, and its erosion opens the door for very bad things. So what's missing? Well, in my opinion, here's where humility comes in. At the core of so many of the faith-shaking failures in business, we see the triumph of pride over humility. You know, think about Enron or WorldCom or Madoff or the banks in the financial crisis, to some of the hedge funds and insider trading today. So a few thoughts on humility in business, or what I would call the paradox of humility. The first paradox of humility is that almost the definition of humility is speaking about humility. So I'm going to give you a disclaimer right up front. I am no expert on the subject, and my own soul has been a great battlefield of pride and humility. So you're probably thinking, you're the CEO of an airline fighting through a bankruptcy. That sounds pretty humbling to me. Well, it is. In fact, in my view, if you're in the airline business and you're not humble, you have not been around long enough. So in preparing to speak to you today, I did a fair bit of reflection on faith and humility in the context of our goal-driven capitalist system. And so I spun deeper into the paradoxes of humility. Of course, in our society, we are taught from an early age to strive, excel, to win at sports and academics, to get A's, to score high SAT scores and go on to the best college and so on. And as adults, we strive for professional achievement and advancement and the admiration of others. And yes, we strive for money. And then we encourage our kids to get A's and high SAT scores. I know I did. So is that bad? I don't think so. Because again, it is this system of achievement and reward which, for its flaws and unequal outcomes, creates the greatest overall outcome for the largest number of people. And we should never, ever shrink from that. But those successes are inevitably the source of pride. And of course, Proverbs tells us pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before the fall. So Scripture is full of teachings on humility, generosity, and justice. And of course, the ultimate act of humility itself. But the Bible calls us to accountability and excellence as part of being good stewards. And we see this so vividly in the parable of the talents. And of course, in Jesus' admonishment, and to whom much is given, much shall be required. Okay, so go out and compete, win, achieve, kick some rear, but be meek and humble. Do things which you can be proud of, but don't be proud. The paradox of humility can really make your head hurt. So I turned to some other thinkers on the subject. The Jesuit theologian, the Reverend Richard Clark, wrote some short meditations on humility, which I found helpful. In particular is what he says humility is not. He wrote, "We are inclined to aim at false humility. Humility does not consist of shutting our eyes to the talents, ability, and graces and accomplishments that we possess. If we have a skill in music, conversation, painting, and languages, it's no humility to deny that. What is contrary to humility is to take credit to ourselves and plume ourselves on what we have received from God." And he finishes, Humility does not consist of self-deprecation. This is often a cloak for pride. And then one of my favorite books, the classic Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. In it, the devil Screwtape is counseling his apprentice Wormwood on the corruption of his human subject, who's referred to as the patient. He writes to Wormwood, "Your patient has become humble. Have you drawn attention to this fact? All virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware he has them. This is especially true of humility." You know, leave it to C.S. Lewis to get it right. So we're called to strive, to achieve, and to win, but not to be proud, to be humble. And if we are humble, to make sure we're not aware of it. So the paradox goes deeper. So I thought a bit about real people of our day who are examples of both great achievement and great humility. And I thought about something that's near to my heart, the space program. I was telling Bruce before I came up here, I grew up in Houston where my dad spent his career with NASA. And our neighbors were actual rocket scientists and astronauts. And I liked John Glenn especially. And one of my favorite stories about him actually relates to a dark time early in NASA's history when the Soviets leapfrogged the U.S. by sending the first man into space. So all eyes were on NASA. So humble, gracious, but determined, John Glenn gets up in front of the cameras and says to the world, "They just beat the pants off of us, that's all. There's no kidding ourselves. But now that the space age has begun, there's plenty of work for everybody." Well, I think you all know what happened next. NASA sparked a fury of American ingenuity, which put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, and the Russians never left the Earth's orbit. So to me, Glenn was a great example of strength and humility. And I think he has lived the rest of his life that way as well. And perhaps the greatest astronaut of all, Neil Armstrong, was very much the same. There were other greatly skilled pilots and astronauts, but those two always stand above the rest. And is it because they were the best or because they were humble? Or were they the best because they were humble? I think it's an interesting question. So I'd like to end with a quick story, which again takes place aboard an American 737. And this is a true story. I didn't talk much about the American Airlines story over the past couple of years. Suffice it to say, it has been interesting. As you know, in addition to restructuring our company, we have been engaged in a very complex merger, which has now even drawn some help from our government. I had convened a board meeting last February 13th in New York to approve the merger agreement with U.S. Airways, which would have created and will create the largest airline in the world. If all went well, it was to be announced the very next day. So early that morning, I was on our first plane out of DFW to LaGuardia, and as I often do, I rode in the cockpit for landing. And very coincidentally, the captain is an old friend of mine from around the block where I grew up. And he's flying the plane. So we're getting close to the New York area. We get the weather for LaGuardia, and it's really bad. You know, middle of February in New York. ATC is vectoring us all over the place. And eventually we get put on final approach for runway 22. And as some of you know, those are pretty short runways, and they're all surrounded by water. So we can see nothing but white out the windshield in front of us. And I'm watching the altimeter, and it goes from 1,000 to 800 to 600, 400, 300, still zero visibility. And at the last minute, the first officer calls the runway lights, and I look ahead, and the nose is just approaching the threshold of the runway. Now, our pilots are incredible pros, and my friend executes a precision approach and just a perfect landing. So we pull up to the gate, all of us a little whiter than we were a few minutes before, and I say, you know, "Great job, Captain." And he knows what I'm up against. It's all over the news, of course. And as I'm getting up to go, he says, "So how's it looking for us?" And I said, "Oh, it's looking just about like that landing." So I told that story, actually, to start our board meeting. Our job was to put the plane on the runway. It's a duty that we owed to 75,000 people who are doing their jobs with amazing skill and humility every day. And Captain Bill was a great example and a steady reminder for me throughout this crazy journey that it ain't about me. So back to where we started. Faith in business, capitalism, and humility. I think we restore faith in business not by apologizing for capitalism, but by striving and winning and always remembering it's not about us. And that's where faith comes in. I had a priest who once said he knew two things about his faith. There is a God, and it's not me. Or to bring this down to the business world, the legendary CEO and founding father of American, C.R. Smith, once said, "At American, we don't have executives. When they get to be executives, we fire them." And I always liked that. So thank you very much for having me here today.
Over to my good friend, Dr. Marshall.
Thank you.
It's a great privilege to be here. I'm grateful to Bill Lawrence and to Todd Raspberry for inviting me to be here, and to Tom Horton for his exceedingly thoughtful remarks. I've attended to one or two of these luncheons before, and so I'm familiar with the setup, the pattern. We pair the CEO of a major North Texas company or a business person of similar accomplishment with a theology professor from SMU, in this case, your humble servant. Now, it struck me often that this setup places the theology professor at something of a disadvantage. This is not because the professor has to follow a business person who is much better known than the professor will ever be, and who is the reason the room is full. That doesn't bother me. I'll have more to say on the subject of humility in a few minutes. The problem is not a disparity of fame or accomplishment. The problem is simply that I know nothing about business. I share my ignorance of business with most university professors, not least theology professors. My parents were both academics, and I grew up thinking that where people worked was the university, and what you did after college was go to graduate school. Not once in my life have I entertained the thought that perhaps I ought to go into the business world. Of course, this is a faith in business lunch, so perhaps it's my job to hold up the faith end of the equation and leave the business end to Tom's able hands. But it can't be quite that simple. I'm a theology professor, so I've thought a lot about faith, about what it is, about the different forms it can take, about what it's good to have faith in and not so good to have faith in. But being able to think about faith isn't the same thing as being faithful. Having good ideas about faith isn't the same thing as having faith. Nor, indeed, does it especially correlate with having faith. Faith is a gift. Some accept the gift, others refuse it. Some cultivate the gift they have received, others receive it, but then let it lie fallow. Academics, I think, aren't any better at accepting it, cultivating the gift of faith than anybody else is. In fact, on the whole, we may be less good at it than most people are. When I need help and guidance with my faith, which I often do, I don't seek it from an academic colleague. I seek it from a priest in my parish whose faith was forged in a Vietnamese re-education camp, or from an elderly Cistercian monk who escaped on foot from Soviet-ruled Hungary and has for 50 years sought a life of holiness in a monastery a few miles from here in Irving. Compared to their faith, mine is as nothing, and their direction is worth more to me than all the ideas about faith that I could ever have. Now, on this score, it seems to me that business is somewhat different from faith. One might have a head for business, as they say, as one could have a head for geometry or music, an innate aptitude. But being good at business, unlike having faith or being wise in matters of faith, isn't wholly a gift from above. It comes from practice, from hard work over many years. Like being good at geometry or music or theology, for that matter, being good at business is a learned skill. This means, though, that I might very well seek guidance on matters of faith from Tom or from anyone else in the room in whom this gift may flourish. So I might seek advice on faith and on business from Tom, if Tom would give me either. But Tom, along with everybody else in the room, would be quite right not to seek guidance on business from me. I've put in none of the effort needed to acquire the skills to make the sort of decisions that he makes every day. So what shall I do to hold up my end of the faith and business lunch? What I'll do is pick up on what Tom has said about humility and add a few thoughts of my own on that subject. I'll do so, of course, from my own point of view, as, like Tom, a Catholic and a convert to Catholicism, as a Christian theologian, and as a person who, like the rest of us here, lives in a particular place in the economy, the economic system that shapes all of our daily lives, that none of us created, and that even the most powerful of us can do relatively little to change. What is humility, exactly? Like love and patience, justice and mercy, humility is a virtue that we probably find it easier to recognize than to define. We know it when we see it. We have an intuitive sense of what humility is. And we also recognize the presence of its opposite, pride. And a lot of the time, we can get along okay simply on the basis of our intuitions about these kinds of important matters, on knowing it when we see it. But sometimes it helps to define our terms. The Apostle Paul comes to our help at this point. Do nothing, he says to the Christians at Philippi, in his letter to the Philippians, do nothing from selfishness or conceit. Conceit, that is the pride that seeks recognition and deference from others. Rather, Paul says, in humility, count others better than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. So humility is counting others better than ourselves. Or translating Paul's words a bit more literally, humility is mutually judging one another to be superior to yourself. Mutually judging one another to be superior to oneself. In Paul's mind, humility is everybody's business. If we know how to look, each of us will find much in every other person that ought to make us humble. As the bedfellow of pride or conceit is selfishness, so strikingly in Paul's words, the bedfellow of humility is looking out for the interests of others. That is generosity and self-giving. Humility, in other words, is not only good for the person who has it, but good for all those around him. Humility makes them, and not just the humble person, better. While pride and the selfishness that attends pride damages everybody else, and not just the person who suffers from it. If that's humility, it's certainly not going to be easy. Why is it nonetheless imperative for us to be humble? Because we had good parents who told us to be humble even while we were seeking A's and high scores on the SAT? Certainly. But ultimately and finally, says Paul, because God is humble. Jesus Christ is the pattern of humility for all of us. This is not so simply because Jesus is a humble human being. That's true, but it's more than that. In Jesus, as St. Paul teaches him to us, we come face to face with the humility of God. Paul writes, Christ Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God something to be grasped at and held on to, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant. And being found in a servant's form, he humbled himself, obediently accepting even death, death on a cross. God is not proud. God is supremely humble. God is humble enough to become one of us, humble enough to deliver himself into our proud and selfish hands for our own good, for our salvation. Our own small share in humility, the little bit of humility each of us is called to show the world, is as nothing compared with the humility of God himself. Why should we be humble? Well, if God can be humble, we can too. Surely, though, there have to be limits to humility. Tom touched on this in quoting from his Jesuit theologian. There have to be some kind of limits to counting others better than yourself. When I went to class this morning, before I came here, I began with a prayer, but I didn't begin by saying, well, I'm a Christian, so naturally I count all of you in the class better than myself. Which of you would like to teach the class today? When I get on Tom Horton's airline tomorrow to fly to North Carolina, I very much hope that neither the captain nor the first officer will be all that humble about his ability to fly the MD-80. I do not expect or want the captain to come on the intercom and say, I'm a humble man and I count all of you better than myself. Which of you would like to fly the plane today? I wouldn't mind Tom's job perk of sitting in the cockpit from time to time, but I don't want to fly the plane. There is, in other words, such a thing as false humility. False humility does no one any good. It doesn't do the pilot or the passengers any good. It doesn't do the teacher or the students any good. Genuine humility, the real thing, is based on reality. That's why it's hard. Real humility doesn't involve saying or thinking someone is better than I am in this or that way when they really aren't. Rather, it involves recognizing the ways in which every other person really is better than I am. Every other person really is better than I am. If the Apostle Paul is right, there will be some way, perhaps many ways, in which every single person is better than I am. It's not just that there are some gifts that I don't have, but that every single person has a gift that I don't have, because of which I should count that person better than myself. This is true whether that person is the CEO of American Airlines or the homeless man to whom I give a few dollars at the corner of Lovers and US 75. So each of us has plenty of opportunity for humility. If we think about it, though, I think genuine humility really is full of consolation. Because humility doesn't urge us to pretend that others are better than us in ways that they really aren't, but to be grateful for their gifts and for their willingness to use those gifts, to put those gifts to good use. The great theologian St. Thomas Aquinas has it right. Humility is recognizing what is of God in every other person. What is of God in every other person. And gladly subjecting yourself, putting yourself under the gifts of God we can expect to find in every other human being. And there is a variety of gifts, an immeasurably rich variety of gifts. Tom has spoken with great clarity and conviction about the importance of humility in a position like his. And he's touched on, although he's too humble to say too much about it, the considerable challenges of being humble while leading an enormous multi-billion dollar company. Allow me to conclude with a few thoughts about what humility and its challenges look like from my own place in the global economy, a place very different from the one that Tom occupies. I make a good living at what I do. And like Tom, I enjoy a salary near the top of my profession. As a tenured professor at a major university, I enjoy, moreover, a level of job security that most Americans cannot even imagine, let alone attain. When you get down to it, though, I'm a wage slave. Like most Americans, I'm only one paycheck away from bankruptcy. By the time I pay the bills each month, there's virtually nothing left. And I have to take out a life insurance policy at significant and increasing expense with each passing year, with each gray hair, so that my wife, in the event that I depart this life unexpectedly, will be able to pay off the mortgage and put our teenage daughter through school. When I ponder these facts, I sometimes find myself tempted to think darkly about humility and capitalism in something like the following terms. I'm guessing that Tom makes roughly as much in a day as I do in a month. This isn't an exceptional privilege of Tom's. The heads of some Fortune 500 companies make a lot more than that, and I have to work for 3 months or six months or more to earn what they make in a day. But let's stick with a month. It's easier to compute that way. On average, there are 30 days in a month. Thus, the CEO of a typical Fortune 500 company makes 30 times more than I do. Does that mean she or he is 30 times smarter than I am? Or works 30 times harder? Or does a job that's 30 times more important? I have to admit that I doubt it. When I think about humility and economic reality in these terms, I'm sometimes tempted to look at someone like Tom and say, well, he'd better be humble. In fact, he'd better be at least 30 times as humble as I am. Because he's got 30 times as much to be humble about. When assailed by this particular temptation, and it is a temptation, I hope I'll have enough faith to entreat God for the grace to ask one simple question. Do I want Tom's job? And to that, the answer comes without a moment's hesitation. No, I don't. But the reason I don't want Tom's job isn't that I don't like seeing my picture in the paper, or that I don't want my family to read unfair and derogatory things about me. The reason I don't want Tom's job is that I don't have the gifts for it. I don't have what it takes to make decisions that affect the survival of a huge company, a company on whose fortunes the livelihood of 75,000 people depends. It's not, I think, that the gifts it takes to do that job are better or more important than the gifts it takes to do my job. That would be false humility. But they're certainly different gifts, and I don't have them. I don't have the gifts to do Tom's job. I have the gifts to do my job. And right there is step one on the path of humility for me. I didn't give myself what it takes to do my job. That's a gift from God, and so an opportunity for humility. More than that, though, God didn't simply give me the gifts it takes to do what I do. He gave me a love for what I do, a love that has only grown since I first realized it was there many years ago. Mysteriously entwined with the gifts it takes to be a theologian has been from the start for me a deep love for theology, for what I do, and a sense of wonder and gratitude at being called unexpectedly to the task when I was young. Since my early years of college, I've had the peculiar happiness of knowing that I was not only doing something worthwhile, but doing what God made me to do, what I was put here for. Now, there's a gift. Tom Horton knows, I think, what it means to have received that particular gift. I hope I can live with at least a little bit of the gratitude and humility that gift deserves. Thanks very much for your attention.
Good job.
Right back at you.
Thank you. Bruce and Tom, thank you very much. I hope that you have a couple of minutes that you can stay afterwards for folks to come and thank you personally. A couple of announcements before you walk out the door today. Please mark your calendars for our next Faith and Business, which is November the 4th, which is Monday. Our Judge Clay Jenkins of Dallas County will be here, and Dr. Abraham Smith from the Perkins faculty will be our co-presenters that day. Thank you all very much for being here. We appreciate it. We'll look forward to seeing you on November the 4th.